I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today we have another mailbag episode with Kyle Nathan, Draws and Fades. Kyle, welcome.
What's up, Andy? Yeah, thanks. Excited to do it again.
Yeah, man. I talked to you yesterday. You said you're grinding on your game for a member guest.
It is a sad state of affairs. I wish I was grinding for the Mid-Am this weekend, but unfortunately, didn't try to qualify. I've been hurt all year. It's just kind of been a wasted year, but trying to grind for member guests is a new low in my golf career, and I just have to accept that.
What are you doing to get ready? How do you prepare for a member guest? I think the people want to know.
Well, you have to go to the ATM and get some cash. That's usually really good at member guests. And that's about it. Unfortunately, since I haven't played very much this summer, my handicap is still in the range where I actually have to try to play decent or I'll let my partner down. And it's actually down in Houston with my buddy John Hunter and at Carlton Woods, which is a very difficult course. So I could shoot in the 80s there in a hurry if I'm not careful. So that's really what my preventative defense is about.
You know, the people are coming at golfers like you this week. You know, lots of questions regarding amateur status and the mini tour players, former mini tour players playing mid-am events now. So let's get right into it. I got two of them right off the bat. Thoughts on amateur status rules and former pros competing with lifetime ams in state and USGA events from Andy Roderick.
Well, I mean, obviously it's not ideal. Myself, I'm a reinstated AM, and I think I probably had, you know, $10,000 in career earnings. So I don't think, maybe if that, you know, it's not really geared toward me. And I get where a lot of guys come from. You get some bigger names. I know Jess Daly played well in the mid-AM a couple years ago. And from what I understand, it's like 35, 40% of the field in the mid-AM is often reinstated former professionals. So the question would be how to combat that. And, you know, it's hard to do money. Money's the only logical thing to me that makes sense, but it's hard to do that because pre-Tiger, the purses were fairly low. So, you know, if a guy's playing the Nike Tour, say, and made, you know, he could have been playing for 3 years and made 40 grand. Which is a lot different than a guy playing 6 tour events and making 80. You know, so it's hard to put money into the equation because the purses have gone up so dramatically.
What if they did like made cuts on nationwide PGA Tour?
See, that would be something. That's a good idea. I would be all for that because I think that, you know, a guy that at 22 goes and plays in mini tours for a couple years and, you know, then he's working for 11 years. I mean, that's an amateur, really. I think they should be able to get their status back. But I agree. If someone makes 18 cuts on the nationwide tour, should they be allowed to get their amateur status back? I mean, maybe. I think they should, but there should be some restriction in some events, whether it's the U.S. mid-am or not. I don't know. But there should be some restriction because otherwise it just gets out of hand. Because, I mean, could Tiger get his amateur status back if he wanted? I mean, technically, yeah, right?
I think so. That's the problem is, like, you look at the reps. Like, Jess Daly's a great example. I mean, he played professional golf on the PGA Tour, the then nationwide tour. I mean, it was, what, 10 years, 12 years?
Yeah, he played for a long time.
Like, me sitting in a desk chair for 10 years versus him playing on web and PGA Tour events for 10 years, like the reps, the practice, the, you know, I sound like Tiger with reps, but like that, that stuff, like it's not, we aren't the same. Like Mike Muir is another good example.
Right.
I mean, he made over $1 million on the PGA Tour in his career, and he plays mid-am stuff. I mean, it just, to me, there's got to be some sort of dividing line. It's one thing for a 22-year-old that goes and tries and, you know, might play a couple seasons on the Canadian Tour and make, you know, $20,000 in their career and come back. Like, that's one thing. But for guys that, you know, have made, you know, a great deal of money on the PGA Tour to the point where, like, you know, you're getting your amateur status back, but your job is hardly going to be that of a kid that, you know, works for, you know, I think one of the toughest things with mid-am golf is, like, early in your mid-am career is learning, like, you're a low-level employee, you know.
Right, that's the one thing a lot of people take for granted, I feel like, is a lot of guys, you know, they get their status back, and we've seen it in Illinois with some of the players, and they automatically think they're going to win every mid-am or am tournament they play in. And it's not the case, because it's hard to balance golf and work. It's really hard, especially when you're starting a career, like you said.
Yeah, but when you've made $1 million on the PGA Tour, like, you're not starting your career.
Right, right.
You're probably doing quite well, and you've met people in your career that can obviously put you in a position where you're not, you know, grinding for paychecks. But I don't know.
I like the cuts made. That seems, you know, of all the options, that seems the best one.
Yeah, it's you know, we gotta get you out of mid-am events. That's the goal, you know. You get all the former pros out, you know, I'd have a fighting chance.
Here's a mid-am question. This is from Mike Wallace. He says, okay, you're Fred Ridley. You decide to give Jeff Knox an invite to the next 5 Masters. He obviously plays as an am. He plays from the same tees as the pros. How many cuts does he make? How many times does he win low am? How many top 10s? Does he contend in all 5? Does he win 1?
So I think Jeff Knox is like the most overblown story in golf. It's like just overhyped. But he's really good. He's a really good mid-am. But is he as good as, like, say, Stuart Hagestad or Scott Harvey? Like, no. He happens to play Augusta as his home course, so that's a big advantage. I honestly think he would make 1 cut out of 5.
That's exactly what I think too. 1 cut, maybe 2. But I mean, at the absolute maximum, I'd say he makes 2 cuts and maybe wins low am 1 time.
Yeah.
Zero top 10s, doesn't contend.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I think he shoots a lot of like 76s.
I'm in agreement. It's much easier to play when you can just pick your ball up, you know, once you're out of the hole.
Mm-hmm. Very you know, beating, he also always plays with like the guy that just shot like 80 on Saturday,
right? He's trying to get the hell out of there.
Yeah, so like that's the other thing. It's like, oh, he beat this guy, but like that guy didn't really care.
They don't birdie 2 and 3, it's, yeah, get me out of here.
I mean, I'm in last place right now. So all right, let's see, we got a lot of questions. So do you have any good putting games that you like to play? And this is from Scott Dudek. He's got this game WAD, but I'm not going to explain everything involved in it. We'll explain it if you don't have any good putting games.
What I do have is the card game. Have you played the card game?
I have not played the card game.
It's kind of fun. So, you know, if you have a foursome, sometimes it works better if you have a couple foursomes. But, you know, say everybody puts $20 into the pot, and then after the round, you start with 5 cards, you know, out of a deck. And every time you get a 1 putt throughout the day, you get an extra card. Every time you 3 putt, you put, you know, say $5 in the pot and you subtract a card. So it's a little finicky, because, you know, if you're on the fringe and you know, that's a 1 putt, if you just get it up and down, whatever. But you know, you wind up some guy, you know, it's not skill based really, but you know, some guys will have 9 cards and they'll have, you know, 4 of a kind. Some guys will have 4 cards and they have no chance to win. It's just kind of a nice little side thing, to do.
You could end up with like a ton of cards, huh?
Oh yeah, totally. And someone else is pumping the pot for you too. So
what do you think about, fringe and putting? I feel like it should count as putts.
It should. I honestly usually do count it as putts when I think about my round. I say, you know, if I put 3 putt from the fringe or get down in 3 from the fringe, I just, to myself, I'm thinking that's a 3 putt.
Yeah, like if it's up against the collar and you use putter, like I feel like that's a pass. It's more of a chip then. But if you're like a foot on the fringe, like that's a putt.
I use my discretion. I mean, sometimes I'll get the chili dips going and I'll putt from 9 yards off the green. I don't count that as a putt, but
do you always pull the pin when you when you're on the fringe?
Yeah, I usually do. I mean, almost always. I know they say, you know, there's no real research, I guess Pels said, right? But if you're downhill, if anything, if you're downhill, leave it in. Uphill, take it out. I almost always just take it out.
My philosophy is, like, I make all my putts with a pin out, so why would I keep the pin in and, like, visually and psychologically have a pin in there?
Right.
Yeah. All right. With the youth movement on the PGA Tour, this is from Andrew Witt, friend of the
pod. Andy Witt.
Should the President's Cup team reserve 2 spots for 35-plus-year-olds, mid-pros?
The old mid-pro. Yeah, it's not a bad idea. We had some other questions about the President's Cup. And I know we talked, we didn't spend too much time watching it. I really, in my whole life, I'm not sure I've spent much time watching it. It just doesn't really appeal to me. It hasn't been competitive. You know, whatever that reason may be, whether the internationals, you know, they have their little twosomes and threesomes of, you know, countrymen, but other than that, they have no greater, you know, patriotism like we do, pulling themselves together. And obviously for something like that, motivation is important. But you know, I think they could make it a lot more fun by making it co-ed. If you had, you know, 6 and 6 or even 8 tour guys and 4 women, you know, I don't watch much women's golf, but I would be interested in watching that way more than the current state. And plus it would be a lot more competitive because I think the international women would have the advantage over the American women. And there's some contrived co-ed events, you know, like the Templeton shootout and all that. But to me, that would be, I would watch that in a heartbeat, and I currently don't watch it. So to me, it would be appealing.
Yeah. I think that originally the idea of like making Ryder Cup 0.2 was a great one, but the execution and like the results thus far have been pretty lackluster. So shake up something, right?
Right. All right. Want to get to our first overrated, underrated?
Yeah. We got tons of them.
Joe Mayberry, overrated, underrated. Opening or closing a round on a par 3.
So I'm gonna say opening, overrated. I hate it. It hitting, like, especially if it's a long iron, like
so brutal.
I had a USAM qualifier like last year, and I was playing really good golf, but I went into it and I had to hit like a 3-iron to like a small green on the 10th hole. And it was just the worst way to start my round. I hit a bad shot and just got all flustered. I was like behind a tree. So I'm out on opening par 3s, and I just like broke my cardinal rule of like using a personal experience in a tournament to but closing par 3s, I actually kind of like them. I think they're cool, especially if it's got a tough green. Like Glenflora Country Club.
That green is jacked. That's a good hole.
I mean, like, it's hard to make I think it's a good test of golf because, you know, with today's day and age, like, it's very rare for people to hit mid and long irons in the game. And I don't mind the closing par 3 because it's like the final test. Like, hey, you got to hit a really good golf shot here with a mid iron. And then you got to be in the right spot to make a putt. Like if you make a birdie, you really earn it on, you know, par 3s generally. What do you think?
I don't really prefer either. Opening is difficult. You know, I feel like whenever you're playing in a shotgun event and you see your first hole is a 4-iron, you're like, oh God, what a brutal break. And closing, I don't know. I think, you know, Eastlake, Greenbrier, there's some out there on tour. I think Congressional did the right thing by switching the finish. You know, 18 is kind of a whatever par 3, and you know, now it's an awesome par 4. So I'm out on both.
John Hunter, your partner, he's got a question for you. What point should I go pro when my handicap finally gets to a 0, or after I win my club championship?
I think you wait till after the club championship. You know, once you can consistently beat 2 and 3 handicaps under pressure, I think the game is sharp enough to turn pro. So as soon, maybe the Monday after the club championship, you go out that night and have a good time and start your next page as a professional the next Monday.
Have a press conference?
Yeah, for sure. At least a Periscope.
The fried egg will start to televise those.
All right, Cody, friend of the pod, Cody Sundberg, wants to know, what is the average tour player's handicap, do you think? +6, +7.
I think about when I play with like Vince India, who's on the web, or like TK Kelly, or Zach Blair, like the times I've played with them, and I need like 5 shots to make it competitive, and a lot of times I still lose. Like, so I would say, like, I play around like +1, +2 when I'm playing good golf, and I would say at least +7. What do you think?
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I think that's pretty spot on. 6 to 8, +6 to 8. Mm-hmm. Do you remember? I'm sure, you know, someone, you guys can Google this, but there was someone wrote an article, excuse me, on Tiger Woods' 2001 season. If you just, you know, the rounds he played, basically he equated to like a +11, I think it was, or something that year. It was just insane golf.
That's the other tough thing is, like, you know, how do you measure, like, because we have, like, the slope and rating stuff is so crazy because, like, you can't, it doesn't measure wind, it doesn't measure conditions. Like I think about, like, tournaments all the time. Like, what's a PGA Tour setup or, like, a U.S. Open shooting 63 in the U.S. Open?
Right.
I mean, is that... Like, what's the slope and rating of that event? You know, is that like a +20 differential?
Right. I agree. The weather has, I mean, there's some, I don't really like the handicap system. I don't know if anyone has a good logical fix for it, but, you know, there's so many things. You play in a 35-mile-an-hour wind on a course that's rated 72 and you shoot 74. I mean, that's not that bad of a round, but not good.
You know, the course, one of the courses I played this weekend, Ballyneal, I loved it, doesn't even have slope and rating. Can't enter a score from there in the handicap.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever heard of that.
Well, they don't have tee boxes. They don't have tee markers. They have tee boxes, no tee markers. You just pick where you want to play every hole.
That sounds like a fantasy land for you.
Ah, spectacular.
Whist for days.
Well, it's like when we played this winter, like, it was windy, and with a couple holes, like, you know, a couple of holes, we wanted to play par fives up, so they were right. Gettable. Like, play them up. Doesn't matter.
Right.
Like, why do we got to be constricted by entering a score?
I like that approach. My dad, to this day, like, has never kept score. He's played probably, I don't know, 6,000 rounds, maybe 1,000 rounds, and he just doesn't keep score. He's like, oh, why would I want to torture myself?
That's amazing. I've cared less and less about score. It's been so much more enjoyable. I think score is overrated.
Score overrated. I'm with you.
Here's one. Benjamin McIntyre, lunch at the turn. Overrated, underrated.
I'm split on this. It depends on your time. Sometimes I'm cool with literally stopping and letting like 4 groups go through and having like a nice luxurious lunch and a couple beers and, you know, having a good time, maybe watching some TV and literally like an hour long lunch. And I love that sometimes, but sometimes you just want to get out of there. And, so I think it's solely dependent on the time you have. What do you think?
So I think it's all based on the time of tee off. So like if you tee off at 10 o'clock on a day, like let's be real. You're not going to really do anything that day. You know, your day is gone because, you know, you tee off at 10. If you play a fast round, you're done at, you know, if assuming the course is busy, you're going to be done at like 2 or 2:30. So you're,
right.
By the time you get home, it's like 4. I mean, the day's over. So on a 10 o'clock tee off time, like, yeah, just chill, have lunch. You know, you just are getting home at dinner time.
Right.
Just pushing back when you get home. I'm going to say underrated.
Underrated. next one, overrated, underrated. General thoughts on driving range versus just playing for practice and improvement.
I've practiced like once this whole year, so I'm going to go with the driving range is overrated. I just go out and hit shots.
Yeah, I think you know where I stand. It's overrated as well. I think that, at least from my own personal experiences, I've played the best golf when I'm barely hitting balls on the range and just playing as much as I humanly can, because I think that, you know, that helps you get sharp under pressure, and, you know, you get so many different shots you'd never hit on the range. I'm a big fan of playing to improve.
Yeah, you know, one of my pet peeves is seeing, like, 20 handicaps just beating balls on the range. It's like, your swing is not, like, good, so you're just ingraining bad habits.
Duval used to say he never hit a lot of balls because when he was hitting the ball well, he knew he was swinging it well. He didn't need to keep hitting balls. His swing was grooved. If he was hitting it bad, he didn't want to keep, you know, grinding the bad swing over and over again. So he just said he didn't hit very many balls. I think there's a lot of guys like that. I know Rich Beem said he basically hit wedges and drivers, and that was about it on the range.
Yeah, this, I think practicing your wedges is underrated. And hitting balls in general is way overrated. I agree completely with Duval. I think using, like, going out and playing with, like, 7 clubs is way underrated too. Because, like,
I agree.
All of a sudden you have to hit, like, 7 iron punch shots from 140. And, like, you hit those shots and then the next round you play, you get into the trees and you've seen this low shot, you know?
Right.
So then you go out and you can hit that shot. So I would say that's a better way to practice than going to the range.
Yeah, I think Sam Snead had a quote. I think he said if he had to do it all over again, he would only hit under 100-yard shots and drivers. And that's all he would ever practice. And you could probably get pretty good, especially in today's day and age, just doing that.
So here's a question I really liked. Why, and it's from Andrew Allen, why isn't there more focus on the rookie reshuffle? Showcase that in the fall and spring instead of the FedEx Cup standings.
I'll defer this to you because I want to know why too. And I think that, you know, your newsletter does such a good job of, you know, previewing the younger guys that for some reason nobody talks about. So
I think so much of it has to do with marketing. I mean, like FedEx pays for the FedEx Cup, but, you know, it's just like, it's kind of like, oh, they paid for this, so we have to do it, versus bringing them an alternative option. Be like, we know this is important, but we clearly see that it's pretty stupid to do here. And why don't we say, like, this FedEx update of the rookie reshuffle, and then all of a sudden, like, you know, like,
right.
the clear reason why you just get FedEx Cup shoved down your throat is because FedEx pays the tour a ginormous sum of money.
Right.
But why don't you just take some of the money they pay for that and say, like, hey, like, we have gotten feedback that this is dumb, so we're going to do something different. Like, what do you think about this? Like, because, like, I think rookie reshuffle and the priority ranking is, like, the most not understood thing for golf fans. Like, a guy could be playing, he could be in 50th place, but he could be on the 18th hole at a certain event based off of, like, the reshuffle when it happens and needs a birdie to get into the next 3 events. Like, that is great drama that's in, like, at the, you know, like, Xander Schauffele is a perfect example. He didn't have good status coming in to last year, but he finished T5th at Sanderson, and that got him into all the events in early 2017, and it allowed him to play and everything. But like, you see it so much is that a rookie that doesn't play well in the fall pretty much has no chance of keeping his card, because like the next start he gets is at Sony. If he doesn't play well there, then the next start he's going to get is at Pebble Beach, and he might get a terrible pro-am partner, you know, and all of a sudden he's 185th in FedEx Cup points when he's making these starts, and he's like, oh shit, I got to play well.
Yeah, to me, that's much more appealing to follow than, you know, the event itself, basically. I think that's, in every sport, we, you know, obsess over rookies like we are with Trubisky coming up here in Chicago. But, you know, there's a focus on rookies where I think the tour kind of lacks that a bit. But
I think one of the things that they got, I think the internet has allowed for, like, the tour is still stuck behind what the internet is and what it can do. Like, you know, like Xander Schauffele has become like an overnight star. Wes Bryan came in with like, you know, start, like people know who these guys are more so right than they did 15 years ago because of the internet. Like, so they're still stuck in like, oh, we need to hype Jim Furyk because he sells tickets. Like, when you could make a name for these guys at a much earlier stage.
Absolutely.
Because of the internet, but they still think it takes 10 years for somebody to become a big name.
So you brought up Xander. We got a couple of questions on, you know, who from this President's Cup team won't be in the Ryder Cup next year, who will be on the Ryder Cup. He was the first name that came to mind that could make the jump to the Ryder Cup next year. Not looking at the points, just going from the eye test, but what do you think?
So I would say that you got Chappell, Hoffman, Kisner are kind of three guys. Like, I don't think all three of those guys aren't going to be on the team. You know, like one or two of those guys isn't going to be on the team next year. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yes. I would. We could throw Phil in there too.
I don't think Phil, I mean, that's a great question. Is Phil going to be on the team if he has a year like he had this year, next year?
I think probably, but you know, I don't, it's by no means a lock.
And, you know, then you look at, so like Xander Schauffele, it'll be interesting to see what he does this year. You've got Ollie Schneider, Jan's had like, I think he had like four or five top tens.
Yeah, he was real. He was consistent.
So, like, you look at a guy that's probably going to win this year. I think he's good. Like, I always look at guys that, if I'm going to look for somebody that's going to break out, it's like find a guy that was in contention like four or five times the year before, but didn't win, and they'll probably win the next year.
Right.
Like, Adam Hadwin was a perfect example of that last year to this year. So like Ollie Schneider Dance, I think, is going to win a tournament this year. So he's one that would be in there. And then you've got all these older guys, like, you know, Snedeker's been injured, but like if he comes back and wins an event or two, like he's probably going to be in. Mm-hmm. Then you've got, I mean, Jimmy Walker's down to 47th in the world, which is kind of crazy. But
wow.
You've got a lot of young guys. Peter Uihlein, I don't think he'll get up there this year, but I would say that Patrick Cantlay's got a good chance of getting on that team. And it's really, you know, somebody's going to get hot. Tony Finau.
Right. If history's been any indicator, there's going to be one out of left field that, you know, wins two or three events next year and gets a spot.
There's three spots that are interchangeable. Those three, Kisner, Chappell, Phil, and Hoffman. So there's probably eight guys that are going to be on. I mean, like Dustin Johnson, Spieth, Ricky, JT, Brooks, Kuchar, Reed are locks, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yep. How many players is that? That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Seven. So you get seven locks, and there's five spots up for grabs, and you could put probably 25 guys in those five spots. And wouldn't be surprised if any of them made it.
Right. That should be fun to watch.
It'll be interesting to see what the Euro team, I think that's almost more interesting, what the Euro team will look like. Because, mm-hmm. like, Westwood's getting old, and you've got Fleetwood. You've got a lot of young guys. Like, everybody bags on the young talent in Europe, but, like, Paul Dunn won a tournament. They got this Italian kid, Renato Paratori, who won. He's 20 years old last year. So,
Paul Dunn's a player.
He is. He's really good. He, that's, I mean, 61 to win is pretty good.
Mm-hmm. He's been in contention, too, a couple times, and obviously played well in the Open.
You've got Dietrich, too, the other Belgian kid that went to Illinois, who's mm-hmm. young. There's a lot of young talent over there.
All right. Let's say you just got back from, you know, Sandhills and Ballyneal. How would you split 10 rounds between the two?
So I've thought about this a lot, and this is like nothing on Ballyneal. I think it's like a world-class golf course and a spectacular golf course, but Sandhills is like a whole nother level of golf that I've probably never experienced before playing there. It would be either 8-2 or 9-1.
Wow.
So I really love Ballyneal, though. Like, it's really, really great. It's just, it's more of a testament to Sandhills than anything else. Like, Sandhills is my my like kind of nirvana. It's mm-hmm. it's got a lot of width. It's all about angles, tons of strategy every hole. You know, you can change the pin and the hole drastically changes. You change, you know, there's a lot of holes. Like, I played 63 holes out there, and there's a lot of holes where I'm still not sure what the right play is. You know, and I That's played awesome. It like six different ways, dropping balls like in later rounds and trying different shots. So it's that place is a spectacular place that everybody should, if they get the opportunity, go out there.
Awesome. All right. Overrated, underrated. Range balls, pre-recreational round.
I think overrated. I don't hit a lot of range balls. I usually just am scrambling to get to the course on time. What about you?
I'm going to say underrated. I actually play a ton of rounds without hitting range balls, and I always get pissed off on like the third hole when I'm two over. I'm like, why the hell didn't I hit balls? So I'm going to say underrated.
Yeah. I don't really care about my score in recreational rounds either, so that's... That's part of why I think it's overrated. What do you think on overrated, underrated on trees in the fairway?
Way overrated. Trees in the fairway are, I mean, I know how you feel about trees in general, but trees in the fairway are terrible. There's a golf course, it's in Briarwood? Is it Briarwood in Deerfield?
Ravinia Green.
Well, Briarwood, both of those, Ravinia Green too, but Briarwood is like 17 great holes, and then you get to the 18th hole and it's a dogleg left with a tree in the middle of the fairway, and you're like, wow, this is the worst hole I've ever played. This course sucks, even though the 17 holes were good. It's frustrating to it's not fair. I mean, it's beyond dumb.
Yeah, you can occasionally pull off a tree in the fairway. Like, that it's okay every once in a while, but it has to be the right spot. But like,
where, you got an example?
I mean, like, Sweden's Cove has one that I don't mind. It's like by the green, and it's mm-hmm. like a short par five. So, like, if you're not going, like, if you're going for the green, it acts like, you know, you're probably coming in and the ball's gonna roll up there, you know. But if mm-hmm. you don't, then you have to hit to a certain side of the fairway that's like 85 yards wide to set up your angle into the green, you know. It just, like, mm-hmm. emphasizes, like, there it kind of emphasizes, like, that, okay, this fairway is 80 yards wide. The worst place I can be is in the middle of the fairway because I have no chance to get around this tree. So it pushes people to play to the edges of the fairway where there are bunkers and you know, there's the property lines on the left. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But
that's okay.
But, like, it's 80 yards wide versus, like, something that's like 25 yards wide and you have a tree in the middle. Like, that's not acceptable.
Agreed.
All right. Here, what's your most helpful putting tools or drills that you use from Luke Smith?
You know, I don't have too many dramatic drills. I kind of stick the two tees in the ground, you know, putt between them. I saw most of the guys do that the last time I was at the Masters, and I was like, well, if they're doing it, I might as well do it too. So I do that quite a bit. That's probably the only, I guess, drill I do. How about you?
I carry a yardstick around with me. I have like this, it's called the Perfect Putting Aid. If it's not like a real yardstick, but you can just go to Home Depot and get like a metal yardstick, and I just put down a yardstick. If you can putt it, I think like a yard without it rolling off either side, you're rolling the ball perfectly.
It is amazing how hard it is to do that, right?
Yeah. Like,
it's amazing. You're like, what the hell? I can't hit a putt a foot, you know, without rolling. It's crazy.
It's like when I'm putting really well, like if I use it a lot, I could start putting really well, but I've used it like twice this whole year. So that's probably why I haven't putted well all year. But like I try and do like 10 or 20 in a row, and like
it's really hard.
The last couple, you're like, please, please just, you know, and it puts a little pressure on it, which is good. And Luke Smith also, do you have any recs for Fort Myers or Naples?
You know, not really. I'm not sure. Is it Corkscrew?
Yeah.
I think that's public.
I don't know. There's not good golf there, really, that's public.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Corkscrew is public. Other than that, you know, someone else asked us what's the best way to get on private courses, and you know, sometimes you can just call and say, you know, you're in from out of town and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it probably works less than 40% of the time, but it can't hurt to try or have your pro call at your local golf course.
You know,
but I think Corkscrew's public.
A good way if you're authentic, like I know that a letter sometimes works.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're very authentic and you like explain why you want to see the golf course, like it would help if like you knew some stuff about the golf course that was why you wanted to see it. Like, you know, I love architecture. Like, don't make it about your personal quest to play the top 100 courses. But, you know, I love architecture. I understand that this course is so-and-so. Like, I'd love to see it. Sometimes that's a good way to get out to some of these places. I don't know, it probably won't work all the time and everywhere, but if people are looking to help you, if you do things the right way, and if that happens, like sending a nice thank you note, that kind of stuff, like it'll help you. Let's see, we got hey, so this is going back to like President's Cup, Ryder Cup, which player that wasn't on the President's Cup would you be most excited to see in the Ryder Cup?
Xander, going back to him, I the way he played in big events at Erin Hills and then in Atlanta was pretty cool to see. I would be very excited to see him play.
You're in on X?
I am. X gonna give it to you.
You've pushed all your chips in. This is why we need the stock market.
Yep, I think in the previous podcast I mentioned I would be all in on Xander.
Staying in Florida, and this is we could go, you know, without public or private, so we could do private and public here. What are some of your favorite courses in Florida, Hirsch, from Hirsch?
I like Loblolly. I like the TPC Stadium course. It's so far north, it doesn't seem like it's in Florida. You know, public, I like World Woods. That's always a fun place to play.
Yeah, that's a good spot.
I think you can play 36 holes for like $100, and it's really good. Trying to think where else. Jupiter Hills. I haven't played Seminole. but obviously that would be at the top of any list.
John's Island.
Oh yeah, John's Island's amazing. Forgot about that too. And then there's another one there. There's a couple courses in Vero. Orchid Island is good. There's a lot of good courses.
Mm-hmm. I'd say
there's a lot of really good courses, not a lot of great courses.
Yeah, I'd say Stream Song courses are good. They're expensive, but they're really good. Winter Park is super cool. You played Winter Park.
I did. That was a lot of fun.
It's not, you know, it's not going to be hard. Like, it is kind of hard, though, for how it's short. It's like 26 or 2,400 yard nine-hole course.
It's just weird. It's one of a kind. You're not used to hitting, you know, the greens are big and undulating, or not, you know, not necessarily big, but they have big undulations in them. And, you know, the bunkers are well manicured, and it looks like you're playing, you know, major golf course, and you know you're hitting, it's 260, you're like, wow, what a weird, it's a lot of fun, though. I love that place. I plan on playing there again too.
Yeah, it's such a cool spot. I played Atlantic Beach Country Club up in Jacksonville. It's a cool little spot. They did the same kind of idea, is that, you know, nothing property, and they had the web finals there last week, but they made it wall-to-wall fairway. It was cool. A place that I didn't get to check out was, which I turned Tron and DJ onto, is called Hyde Park, and it's in Jacksonville. It's originally a Stanley Thompson design that they think is a Donald Ross, but like supposed to be really good. I got to see it next time I'm down there. Mountain Lake's awesome course. I played this place called Shingle Creek that just got redone by Arnold Palmer's guy, Thad Layton. And he did a really good job, basically just kind of redid all the greens. And he had budget to basically do everything inside 100 yards. So you see really cool green complexes, really cool bunkering. I'm not sure on the price kind of fluctuates there. Sometimes it's pretty pricey, which kind of turns it off. But, you know, Orlando doesn't have a ton of great options. It's decent, and they did a really good job with what they had to work with there. I don't think Tampa lost that Bellevue Biltmore, the Donald Ross course there. I guess some guy bought it from, I don't know how that happened. They bought it from the municipality, and he's
going to. Tomasia in Tampa is really cool.
And then, of course, I want to go see is Tim Aquana, another one. Mm-hmm. There's not a
Old
ton
Memorial,
of
good. Old Memorial, we left off that list.
Yeah, Old Memorial is a good one too that I haven't seen. Florida, yeah, good, not great. Lots of courses though.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
How about this one? Spieth was so wrong on the penalty he was given on Saturday at 12. He acted like a spoiled little millennial. Does this bother you? That's from Bill, who is at DJ D Johnson Swag.
So I think he just didn't I mean it's like the perfect example of like the ruling was right, but the situation, like the ball wasn't going, like picking up the ball in motion you shouldn't do, but like the given the circumstance, you know, right?
It's tricky. No, I've been critical, as you know, about on Spieth at times for carrying on and this and that, but I don't think he was in the wrong with his questioning and, you know, hands in the air. And I probably would have been the same way, because, you know, it didn't affect the hole one bit whatsoever. I get that, you know, it could hit a meteor and bounce back and go in the hole, I guess. I get why they called it. It's just one of those things you have to deal with, I guess, sometimes in golf. Just, you know, it is what it is. It was bizarre. And, you know, that's why you saw kind of the exasperated looks of Tiger and Jordan, where, you know, there's not much you can do. It's just kind of it's just up to the rules official, and, you know, you got to call the rules the way they are, and just unfortunate.
You know what it's kind of like? It's kind of like in the NBA when guys go for the intentional foul and the guy just like chucks up a shot.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like that. Like, you know the guy isn't going to make that shot, but if, like, you just can't do it, you know?
Right.
It's, you know, another interesting question we got was from Brendan Porath regarding stymies, if they should be allowed back into match play. I mean, this is a great, great question. I kind of am in on stymies.
I think when I first read the question, I was like, absolutely not. And then I started thinking about it more, and it would just be, you'd have to develop a whole new skill, right? Because you wouldn't be playing the same way and just being like, oh, shit, there's a ball in my way, you know? But you'd have to really plan your way around and come up with some spinning putts and whatnot. But, you know, I'm fine with maybe one event a year if they really wanted to do it. But no more than that. I mean, I'm cool with one event. I'd like to see it. It doesn't even have to be a sanctioned tour event. Maybe one of the silly season events, but sure.
I think one of the things is, like, you know, golf, like stroke play that's beaten down your throat is like, you're not playing the field, you're playing the golf course. But match play, you aren't playing the golf course, you're just playing the man, you know, your opponent. So the idea of, you know, hey, I hit this out of bounds, and now I can kind of like, I'm not out of it because I could stymie this guy. I guess you'd still be kind of screwed.
Can you imagine being like, I don't know, 6 inches out of someone's line on a putt and just kind of going up there and one-handed tapping your ball right in the middle of his line? Like, what a disrespectful move.
It's kind of amazing, though.
It would add some drama. Now the more I think about it, I'm in.
Then you could make the putt, and they'd have to play away from the hole, and maybe instead of having, like, a foot, they have, like, 3 feet. Like, it would eliminate the ability to just, like, cozy the ball down to the hole.
I just picture a golfer literally, you know, just whoop, going through his pre-shot routine, tapping it like a foot, and then taunting the other guy.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm excited for that.
Yeah. I think stymies are, we might have to get stymies into something. We just test it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one silly season event.
What's your favorite PGA Tour event that's not played in the States?
Do you count the British Open?
Let's go no on that. I guess there's not that many.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm not really in on any of the Asian events.
Yeah, I haven't really watched much of them. I know Malaysia has a lot of good golf courses, you know, and obviously Shenzhen. But yeah, I'm not all in on them either.
Remember last year the Hero when Tiger came back and looked really good?
Yeah, he was like almost holing out on par 3, spinning the club and everything. He was back.
That's like depressing.
I can't believe that was not even a year ago. That's crazy, isn't it?
He looked so good that week. It's kind of that damn flight. It had to be that flight. But I guess, you know, if that was the case, it would never have held up.
Right, through the rigors of the season.
Do you use the Plumb Bob? This was a question from Jeff W.
No.
I don't understand it. I've never understood it.
I guess I know how to do it, and I'm not really sure. I guess if I'm really either putting horribly or completely stumped, I've tried it. But, I mean, I'm not going to make a good stroke generally if I'm putting on a Plumb Bob read because I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's like, if you don't know what's going on, you're not going to hit a good putt. That happens to me a lot. That's why I hit a lot of bad putts.
Here's one for you. You've been to L.A. recently. Favorite public course in L.A. and overrated, underrated off-season for golf in L.A.?
So, I lived in L.A. for a little bit, so I identify with this. I played a lot less golf than I play in Chicago. I completely agree with what Sal Hutton said here. He said, since living in L.A., I golf way less than in Canada. I don't know what it is. Like, you all of a sudden do more stuff. You're used to the weather being nice, so you kind of play less. Favorite public course. Rustic Canyon is really good. It's a course that Jeff Shackelford and Gil Hance designed together. It's about an hour away. It's cheap. It's like, I think it's like $60 to walk on the weekends. It's walkable, which is rare out there. In the city, I love Rancho Park. I used to live like a four blocks from it, so I'd play there all the time. It's slow. It takes forever to play. It's in bad condition, but it's cheap, and it has like a ton of potential. It's got like, you have to hit really good golf shots there because it's got, you know, good land. It used to host the LA Open. It's a really good. If that's to be my one course. I think we had another question about what course you'd want to. Oh, that was in Chicago. That's a good question too. We'll get to that one next. But Rancho Park, I really love too. But I would say Rustic Canyon's the best one in the greater LA area. So I'm not a big fan of Oak Meadows. It's in Chicago that just underwent a renovation. So Kyle, of all the courses in Chicago, public courses, which one would you like to see get a renovation done? And then we can also expand it out to the country. So two answers.
Okay, Chicago, I'm going to go a little far from Chicago and say the General at Eagle Ridge in Galena. I think the topography is pretty cool out there. And that golf course is just bad. And I feel like it shouldn't be. They have the land, they have the rolling hills and all that, and water. I mean, they literally have everything you need to build a good golf course, but not the golf course. So that would be my Chicago pick, even though it's probably two and a half hours outside of Chicago. Mm-hmm. Nationally, let me think about that. Why don't you go?
So I would say in Chicago, there's a course called Big Run.
I love Big Run.
I love playing there. It's so fun.
It's fun. It's a really fun layout.
It's on like a crazy piece of land for Chicago. Mm-hmm. And the course is always in just horrendous condition. But it's so much fun to play. There's way too many trees. But I don't think you'd need to do that much there to make it really good. So I'd say Big Run would be my place that I'd go in and take a knife to if I had, you know, $5 million. Or even Ravislow. It's done a renovation, but I just like chop down a ton of trees. I take down every tree and make it really firm and fast. And I think that place would be crazy fun. But then across the country, it'd be between Sleepy Hollow in Cleveland I'm getting old. I can't believe I just... Rancho Park in L.A. Can't believe I almost just forgot that. So those would be my two.
I don't know that I really have one for the country. I guess, you know, somewhere in Florida.
Somewhere near me. What about the course that you live on?
Right. Heron Bay?
Yeah.
That would actually be a good one. The land's flat, but you know, they used to have the Honda here, and it is a huge golf course. I mean, it's like 7,300, or you know, it plays long. It might even be 7,400, and it's just in the shittiest of shape. Like, I mean, real bad. And it's a nice community. They stopped caring about the golf course. I think they're planning on getting rid of it. But yeah, you could build. I mean, you already have the course. I mean, you could literally build a tour event course out there. I just don't know if they're interested in doing that. But yeah, there you go. Right down the road.
What do you think, here's from Neil Smith, overrated, underrated golf pencils with erasers?
Underrated, because when I'm keeping track of scotch, I sometimes make mathematical errors, and then you add it up and you realize it doesn't equal zero, and then you have to go back and you know, you're already keeping score and money, so it's, you need an eraser in case you make an error, yeah, which I'm prone to do.
I'm pretty absent-minded, and I keep score for three holes, and then I forget to write down scores for five holes, and I need an eraser, because then I'll a lot of times write my score in the wrong spot. I'll flip-flop scores with other players. Basically, you don't want me keeping score.
Yeah, Jesus.
Not a good scorekeeper, but so I need a pencil with an eraser.
How about this one? What's the best caddy you've ever? Who's the best? What's the best caddy you've ever had, or who?
You know, I've got my cousin caddies for me a lot. Like in the summer, if I'm like in the stadium, and he's a high school baseball coach, and he used to be he played like pro baseball for a little while. He's a pitcher, and I think pitchers like get golf because it's not. Like every other sport is reactionary for the most part, and golf's the only place where you have to think about it, and a pitcher has to think about it too. And so he kind of gets the mental process of it, and he knows, you know, he's a coach, so he knows how to like talk to you in moments. I think that is the, and he doesn't try and tell me what to do. Like I don't like when caddies read putts for me unless I ask, because like, how do you know how hard I'm going to hit the ball?
Right.
You know, like so much of reading a putt is dictated on how you're going to hit it in a situation.
Oh yeah, there's three different reads for every putt, right?
Mm-hmm. So I think the best caddies are the ones that understand how to communicate with you. What do you think?
I agree with what you said. This made me think of my worst caddy experience ever. So I was playing in the Western Junior. I was probably 17 years old, maybe 16. It was at Sea Island. I got randomly assigned a caddy, and you know, I meet him on the first tee, the first round, and he seems like an okay guy. You know, cool guy, probably 25, enjoying the walk for the first few holes. We get to I forget the hole. It's the dog leg right with the marsh on the left. But anyway, I'm like, hey, can you give me the 5-wood? And he's like, no, man, don't be a pussy. Hit driver. And I was like, I was already like 2 or 3 over, and I was already flushed in the face. And I was like, oh, okay, give me the driver. So I hit driver, snap hook it in the marsh, make double on the hole. And I'm like, okay, that sucked. What an asshole. And a few holes later, he's like, oh, so Chicago, huh? And I'm like, yeah, Chicago. He's like, oh, man. One of my best times I've ever had, I was on a bunch of acid at Wrigley Field. It was awesome. I was like, oh, God, I just fucking listen to this guy. Are you kidding me? So be careful listening to caddy's advice is what I would say. Make the final decision.
I had a great caddy in the Radix Cup this year. He didn't say much. He was quiet, and he just delivered like the best moment of maybe my golf of the summer. Was, you know, I think we were one down in our match, and we were on the 15th hole, and I busted a drive, and it was a short par 5. I knew I needed like a birdie or an eagle, probably an eagle, you know. So I turned to him and I go, all right, we need to make a big bird here. And he looks back at me, and he was a real quiet kid, and he goes, not big bird, jumbo bird, like albatross. But I only made a regular bird, but it was good enough to, but it was, I just burst out laughing. It was like,
gave you all the looseness you needed.
Yeah. You know, it's a good caddy doesn't, it's like, you got to pick your spots. You can't talk too much, but
right,
like when you talk, you know, make sure it's worthwhile. Don't talk my ear off, but you know, have some good quips, you know?
All right, here's another question. Can you explain again why par is just a number and how that may or may not make a golf hole a bad long par 3 versus a great short par 4?
Yeah, the perfect example of this is like Riviera, where the first hole is 500 yards downhill, par 5, and the second one is like 480 par four coming back up the hill. It's like, okay, so like one of them's a par five and one of them's a par four. But like in reality, like a lot of the second hole a lot of times plays tougher than the first hole. So like it, you know, it goes par five, par four, but really in actuality, it doesn't really, like if you get make nine on the two holes, like you haven't lost anything on the field really. You know, eight is a good score, but you think about it longer, like on certain days and conditions, like, you know, a par five could be playing like a par four. Or like a perfect example is like Sandhills, where I played this week. Like there's this great short par five on the back nine. It's like the 14th hole. And earlier with the wind we played, it was hard off the left. So it played short. I hit like nine iron and wedge into it the couple times I played it. But then on the front nine, there's a 485-yard par four, the fourth hole, that played dead into the wind to like a tiny green. And I was hitting three iron and four wood into it. Like that, you know, like par doesn't matter. Like if [S2] Right. [S1] You make a four on both of them, like you've done well. But like if you make a five on the par four, it's not really a bogey. Everybody's going to be bogeying that hole. Does that make sense?
To me, it does. Yeah, I completely follow and agree.
I think, and also, like, when we look at, like, the U.S. Open, like, this is, I think, where most people were clapping at me when I said par doesn't matter, and everybody's like, I don't get it. Like, the game's fundamentally changed with, like, equipment. So, like, why are we holding on? Like, why don't you just make the par 68?
Right.
Like, don't put associate pars to holes and just say, this is a par 68. You know, like, this course, Ballyneal, has no slope and rating, and they, unfortunately, I was kind of disappointed that they had par, but like, why not just take par off golf courses?
Yeah, it literally means nothing.
It means
you don't need it to play in a handicap match. You just need a handicap for that, or handicap holes, I should say. But I mean, it literally bears nothing on the day.
Because you could play great and shoot even par. And you could also play great and shoot four over par. But that day, clearly the par wasn't even par.
Right.
Like, it wasn't 72, it was 76. Like, that's, like, the thing that I think is the problem with it. It's, like, you're associating a number that doesn't tell the whole story. Like, that number doesn't apply every day. And it kind of goes to this greenskeeper revenge question we got. What do you think about, like, hard course days and days where you know... the greenskeeper gets to put pins in crazy places?
I think they're fun. I always enjoy playing in them. It's amazing how hard they actually are. You think like, oh, it shouldn't be that bad. You know, shamble or scramble, whatever format you decide to play. You're like, oh, it won't be that bad. And then you get out there and you're like, holy shit, this is impossibly hard. Mm-hmm. So I think it's cool to just to see how hard a golf course could play if you could put the pin anywhere and, you know, tease back and all that.
Yeah, it's I kind of like I like the big cup days with crazy pins.
Played the big cup at Glenwoody?
I haven't.
Oh god, that is the most insane thing. I mean, literally it's a big cup, which is the size of a sprinkler. And you know, I've played with really good teams where we had four guys that were, you know, +3, +4, and you make doubles on holes. You put it right in the water, right in the bunker, right in the water. I mean, it's insane.
And it's a scramble too, right?
It's a four-man scramble, yeah. It is crazy. It's cool experience. If you're around there, it's in October in Chicago at Glenwoody. Go play it just to be like, what the hell? How do we just make triple in a four-man scramble?
Yeah, I think just alternative formats I'm all in on. Mm-hmm. I think golf should just, you know, you should do different shit with it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. This is about it for me here. You got any other questions you should do?
I'm good.
Yeah. What, you going to watch any of this this tournament this week, Silverado?
I actually probably will. You know, I've been to Silverado a bunch. My parents are big Napa fans, as they're big wine fans, and we used to always go to Silverado, and I love the golf course. I was shocked a few years ago when it got a tour event, because I always thought of it as a extremely fun golf course. But I didn't really realize it was going to be a tour event golf course. So it's cool. I like the golf course a lot.
Yeah. I get more excited about these fall events than I do about like the FedEx Cup playoffs, which is.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
I like the fresh blood. It's like what we talked about earlier. I like seeing the new guys. I like seeing, you know, it's a fresh slate. Like a lot of guys that struggle, like you survive, you get the new season, and it's like, oh, you feel like new life. And I'm a big fan of the fall events. And so, but yeah, we'll talk in a week or two. Thanks for all the questions.
Yep. Thank you, guys.
All right. Bye. Yep.